Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. I hope all those of you who celebrate have had a lovely Easter. It's always nice to be with Kieran. It's Monday in your world. It's Monday, April the 1st. In your world, it's still Sunday in our world. Kieran's excited about Liverpool v Brighton, showcasing Roberto De Zerbi's desire to be the new manager of someone. He clearly wants out of your place, Kieran, doesn't he?
He does, and I've never seen a better come-and-get-me approach than losing 4-0 to Roma, 3-0 to Fulham, and 4-0 to the Giants of Luton Town in the course of the last weeks when showcasing your talents.
This is... It's a bad weekend for us, Kieran, this weekend. I love Easter, but it coincides with the clocks going forward, Kieran, which depresses me, as you know, because I cannot stand the light evenings. And also, you lose an hour. You can't afford to lose an hour. You've got too many spreadsheets to deal with without nature taking an hour of your time. That's terrible. Anyway, Kieran, as I say, Monday, April the 1st, it's Questions Day, but we do have... a big news story, Kieran, you're telling me. Breaking news story.
Yes. So I was contacted by one of the journalists that we deal with. And as we know, that Sir Jim Ratcliffe has been angling for a new Old Trafford. And I think that's a really good idea. Rather than continuing to try to grow it a bit like a Lego or a Jenga, which is what they have done historically, to take something similar to the Spurs approach. By all accounts, he's disappointed with the response that he's had from the UK government in terms of not being able to access the Levelling Up Fund. And he's also unhappy that we've had recent increases in corporation tax rates as far as UK companies is concerned. So he's been in contact with the Irish authorities, and there's close historical links between Manchester and Ireland, as anybody that's lived here. I lived in Manchester for 40 years would know, with a view to getting some grants from the Irish government, which would be fantastic from them, and shifting the location of the Manchester United Stadium to Dublin. So the benefits with that, A, you would get financial support in terms of the construction of the stadium. And we're looking at a fee of around about £1.5 to £2 billion. And in addition to that, you would only be paying tax at 12.5% on the profits. So from his point of view, that there's financial benefits to that. That would help the Glazers. That's the downside, because it would increase the value of Manchester United. But certainly the lads I know, there's lots of snippy comments about Manchester United fans. But I used to play for Trafford Cricket Club, as I said, on many occasions, and we were split 50-50, apart from me and the Prowler.
The Prowler and split 50-50. I mean, this is a huge story, Kieran, which obviously we'll be keeping an eye on, because it's very much in the realm of breaking news. But I wonder, Kieran, if when they do move to Ireland, if they do, and there'd be a lot of hurdles to overtake, whether they'll change the name to Manchester United. That would, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Well, that's a big story to keep an eye on, Kieran, in the rest of the upcoming weeks of the year. A big story. Our first question, Kieran, rather appropriately for Easter weekend, comes from Peter Lord.
I think producer guy does look at the names clearly.
I think he does. Okay, I think Peter Lord's question may have been jumped up the queue just so we can have a question from Peter Lord on Easter weekend. But as it is Easter weekend, Kieran, I'm going to deny the answer to this question three times. each answer you give me, I says no, don't know it. Peter Lord says, on a recent pod, you mentioned that the average championship losses are around £470,000 a week. And even now, Kieran, I have to say, reading that out aloud, it just still sounds ridiculous. £470,000 a week. But Peter Lord says, I thought that under FFP, losses had to be under £13 million a year, which works out around £250,000 a week. Does this mean that a significant element of the losses are outside of FFP? Good question, Peter.
Yes, yeah, and a fair question as well, Peter. Bless you. when I've quoted this figure of £470,000 a week, this is from what I refer to as the football club's underlying trading activities. So where do clubs generate money from? They generate it from ticket sales. They generate it from the broadcast deals, including solidarity payments and parachute payments and the EFL's MTV deal. And they develop it from, or they generate it from their commercials deals. That excludes the player trading model. That excludes player sales. And the reason for that is that player sales are erratic. They're volatile. In some years, you will have substantial amounts, and in some years, you'll have zero. And you've seen the same at Palace. You know, you think about the year in which you sold Aaron Wan-Bissaka compared to the following season. Yeah, there was a £40-odd million pound difference between the two. So we strip those out from the world of finance. So that contributes something towards that gap of £200,000 a week. In addition to that, we have the specific expenses which are excluded from FFP. So you've got your academy. Now, the costs of running a Category 1 academy, from what I've heard, are normally in the region of £4 to £6 million a year, or at least that's the budget that you will show to the bean counters from the EFL. We've got our secret account academy manager who is quite grumpy because he's the man that has to collect the cones at the end of the day. And I know one of them, one of the guys said, yeah, I've got a budget of £6 million, but I'm only actually allowed to spend two of it. The rest of it goes to the first team and it's disguised as an academy spend. But, that's a separate issue. So you've got around about, probably £4 to £6 million for a Category 1 academy. At championship standards, it will be substantially more in the Premier League. Category 2 academy, you're probably talking £1 to £1.5 million. You've got your infrastructure costs, the depreciation on the stadium. That's to encourage clubs to invest in facilities, to invest in improving what's available to both their talent in the form of players with regards to training facilities, and also in terms of the stadium facilities and so on. And again, a perfect example of that would be Spurs. Spurs' infrastructure costs are around about £70 million a year compared to a pittance at some of the other clubs in the Premier League. Yeah, be a tenth of that. And the facilities at Spurs are absolutely amazing. So you can see the benefits there. The women's team, the community scheme, again, those are all excess. So that helps to bridge that particular gap. And this is where I get, from my point of view as somebody from an administration and insolvency background historically, that this is where I get a little bit narky, because A, you're allowed to lose £39 million over 3 years, so that's not sustainable. So why do they call it sustainability rules? And secondly, by the time you take into consideration all of these issues, it means you can probably lose £50 to £60 million over 3 years, and you'll still be within the limit. So that's how we get to that sort of that difference between the 470,000 that I quote, which I do feel is appropriate, and the 250,000 that we're actually allowed to lose.
Cracking banner at Spurs on Saturday, Kieran, a protest against Tottenham removing the concession for older supporters. A massive banner, saying with the words, no club for old fans. Oh, yes. Very good. I'm pleased to see that campaign taking off, actually, I have to say, because it's something we've discussed and I think we will continue to discuss. And I should point out to listeners as well, if you think our secret academy manager is grumpy, you should meet our secret groundsman. He's He's furious. He's the one who's I'm never going to reveal his identity because he's grumpy enough as it is. Our next question, Kieran, if Peter Lord was symbolic of this weekend, this next name, Kieran, is symbolic of the rest of the year. This next question comes from Jimmy Lager. Now, I'm hoping that that's a name that's been changed by Deedpole, Kieran, because it's. I'd like to know the circumstances. But anyway, Jimmy Lager, I just imagine it'd be great every time he turns up. Here he is. It's Jimmy Lager. What are we having? I'll have a pint of Jimmy. Thank you very much. An interesting question, though, from Jimmy. It's probably Lager, isn't it? I'm guessing it's probably Lager. It's probably been.
Presumably, if he moved to Brighton, he'd have to change his name to Jimmy Craft Ale or something like that.
Yeah, well, sorry, you made me giggle. That's my normal giggle. Some people don't like my giggle, Kieran. They find it sinister. Jimmy Lager says, my club, Bath City, has at least 10 associated sub-organisations that use the basic black and white striped logo, but with minor tweaks. So these include the club's foundation, youth teams and supporters club. If a football club makes a significant change to their logo, is budget also allocated to these sub-organisations so they can make the required changes? Presumably things like replacing stadium signage, new business cards, restocking merchandise, etc. would all be factored into the expected rebrand costs. But I imagine it could be challenging for those sub-organisations to find any budget for logo or signage changes, especially at National League level or below. From a branding perspective, it wouldn't look great if half of the sub-organisations couldn't afford to make the logo changes needed. I think it's a very interesting question, Kieran. And again, you could probably say if Bath City had one of them golden chairs, this is the sort of thing that would be discussed or banned. So how far down does the logo change go, Kieran? How would it be funded?
I suspect this is one of those things which isn't thought through at the time. And when you're going for a makeover of a brand, and you know, we're old enough to remember Windscale becoming Sellafield and so on, and Margaret Thatcher throwing a very hissy fit when British Airways changed their logo to something she didn't like. It can be very expensive for the organisation. They will have employed management consultants, brand consultants at very expensive fees who will justify those fees, will say, well, yeah, the benefits is that the organisation looks more progressive, it looks more in keeping with the message that the organisation wants to get across, and so on. But the problem that you have with any form of rebrand is that your costs are very easy to calculate. You've got the physical cost of the rebrand. As Jimmy's rightly said, you can work out your signage costs, you can work out having to change the livery of vehicles and so on. The benefits are intangible. The benefits, you know, how can you say over the course of the next 5 years whether or not BT, for example, has improved its position by, it's probably got, for me, the worst logo of any organisation. At least it used to be relatively, sort of personal. It's now just the letters B and T in a circle. It is thoroughly baffling. But that will have cost them a lot of money. Now, when it comes to a football club, we have seen quite a few clubs change the brand, change the logo. When the Glazers took over, they changed Manchester United Football Club. They took away the words football club. They changed it to Manchester United. And this does have a ripple effect on all of the other elements of the club. Now, for a club at Premier League level, to a certain extent, those costs are actually going to be borne by the kit manufacturer as part of the design. So it wouldn't be too significant. And you can do that perhaps over a 12 to 18 month period. For a club of position of Bath City, you know, where they are in the tiers of football, I think there would be a disconnect if the sub-organisations were not allowed to rebrand at the same time. They would feel that they were perhaps being marginalised as a result of this. And it would be very difficult to see how the benefits would outweigh the costs. But I can assure you there will be somebody there with a pair of dynamic glasses and braces who will present in a... in a PowerPoint presentation, a very persuasive argument. But I'm always slightly skeptical, and this isn't me just being adopting a dog in the manger attitude to these things. Brand reboots are there for the creative industry rather than the industry being adjusted itself.
For worst logo, Kieran, I'm going to give you Burton Albion's badge. It's shocking. It looks like a pregnant Eiffel Tower here, and it's not a good logo. The branding thing, there's two questions off the back of that. I don't think you'll be able to answer the first one. I still, and I've asked people this, I've asked people who work for the organisation, and they can't tell me. I still can't quite work out why BT Sport is now TNT Sport, because it doesn't bother me in any way, shape or form, but I just can't understand why they did it. And when you talk to people at a fairly senior level in the organisation, you go, I don't know, we just got a memo saying, can you tell people to stop calling it BT Sport in 4 weeks' time? But the kit thing is interesting, Kieran, because it, you know, Palace and Brighton will change their kit for next season, will tweak their kit. How far down? Because you know, there was a stage when Palace were strapped for cash when the academy or the youth teams would still be wearing last season's kit when the first team were wearing this season's kit. So when how far down does the food chain are the kit manufacturers supplying new shirts? Is it going down to the under-14s, the under-12s, or are the club, after a certain level, are the club buying them themselves?
Right. I mean, there's two great questions there. In respect of the first one, BT have effectively sold their sports broadcasting to TNT, so it's much of a sellout, and that's going to be over a period of time. So they've set up a joint venture. As part of the joint venture, it does involve a change of name. I'd still tend to call it or think of it as BT Sport. It will take time. And we've also said the same with regards to stadium names. You know, it's the Reebok, it's the Rico for me. And I think this is where Spurs are on a sticky wicket, because Spurs fans I know still call it White Hart Lane. The media call it the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is it's just too much of a mouthful. But the value of that is decreasing all the time. Talking to one of our secret kit manufacturers, and also to some of the people we know at clubs, the deal will be for a set number of shirts that you will get for free as part of the kit manufacturing deal. Now, if you are Manchester United or Liverpool, you'll probably get 100 shirts per player, because they know that loads get signed after matches, and so they will be very, very generous deals. I seem to recall when we did our show at Accrington with Andy Holt, he said, you know, we get a fixed number and it's not that many. And quite often you will then see the academy using last year's first team shirts. And from a sustainability point of view, that makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, I don't have a huge issue with that. When it comes to the academy, again, that will be part of the overall negotiations. The bigger clubs who have bigger academies will say, if Nike, if Adidas, if you do want our custom, then we'll want quite a few. If you're in the lower leagues, then less so. And as we established when we were talking with regards to the price of the New England kit recently, the cost of producing an adult shirt is probably in the region of £12 to £15. Kids' shirts would be that much cheaper. It's not actually costing the manufacturer. You know, if you put out 10 shirts per academy per player, and you've got 25 kids in the academy, 250 shirts isn't actually going to cost you an awful lot of money. So it's a cost which they are prepared to bear, and also people will get, it's free advertising for your logo, and what Accrington do, I think, is that they go to every school in Accrington at the age of nine, and they give the kids a free shirt, because it is a competitive market that they're in. It's a crowded part of the geographical landscape of football.
Hi, Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question, Kieran, comes from Brian Stewart. Not quite as glamorous a name as Jimmy Lager, but solid, strong name. Brian Stewart, I imagine, would be opening the batting for your local village team. Probably secretary of the committee as well. That's that sort of strong name, Brian. And Brian Stewart's question. Kieran has mentioned more times than I have counted the transfers of Arthur and Pjanic and how the amounts were convenient for FFP purposes. That's true, Kieran. It is one of your go-to examples.
It is, yes.
If, though, says Brian Stewart, if player transfers were removed from being included in profit and sustainability rules and set loss figures were agreed, do you think that would give greater transparency and improve club financial stability?
I think if we were to go down that route and remove the benefits of player sales, then it would only be appropriate to remove player costs as well. Otherwise, you've got one side of the equation included in the FFP calculations and not the other. I wouldn't be keen on this for the very reason, and this is not self-interest because of Brighton being quite useful at player trading in recent times, in the sense that for some clubs, developing players is very much part of the overall business model. We've mentioned already today that we've got matchday income, commercial income, and TV money coming in. Well, I know certainly some clubs, they budget to sell one player a year. And they've got that budget will be going to be what we might call a decent player. And you might say, well, that's only going to apply to the small clubs. It doesn't just apply to the small clubs. You take a look at Manchester City. Yeah, they sold Raheem Sterling. They sold Leroy Sané. They sold Mahrez and so on. So that's what City look to do. Sort of one player, he would say, he's not a 40-game-a-season starter, but he's a 25-game-a-season starter, and we can generate, 30, 40 million at least in respect of that. So it is something which all clubs do take into consideration. It does assist those clubs that perhaps have an advantage in area X. It could be that they don't have as big a global fan base, but they're very good at talent spotting. Take a club such as Peterborough. Absolutely amazing when it comes to talent spotting at Peterborough. And I don't know whether you saw Ivan Toney's performance yesterday. He was just on fire, a fantastic player, which is not good news when you're away to Brentford on Wednesday evening with yet another come and get me performance from Robert De Zerbi. So I personally think that, but if you take such an approach, it's not giving clubs credit for their ability to be talent identifiers, to be able to develop players, to improve them, and to get the financial rewards. My view is, and I do not have any inside track on any of this, I can assure people, my view in terms of increasing transparency would be that as part of the licensing agreement, if the regulator does take place, and I think the first reading we're fairly close to, and the second reading's probably by the end of April, I would anticipate, that clubs should produce a de minimis amount of data, which will allow I'm not talking about nerds like me, because I do it from a nerd point of view, for the custodians of the club who are the fans to be able to allow them to say to the club, we're a little bit concerned about X, Y, and Z, but also from the club's point of view, because we've seen those clubs that do make an effort to engage with fan bases. You know, and I'm here when talking about, you know, clubs such as Lincoln, Tranmere Rovers, and so on. And they put out comprehensive information. Chesterfield are very good at it as well. That you actually get fans to take a step back and stop saying, "Oh yeah, yeah, okay, you're not just a walking checkbook. We now understand where the money's going," and it can act in the club's behaviour. But so many clubs owners are suspicious of anybody doing analytical work that they're not prepared to go down that route. And I genuinely think that that's counterproductive. As fans, we're not all idiots. We do care about the future of the club. Often we care about the future club more than the owners do, because some owners are looking at things from a short-term perspective. And that's certainly one thing I would be keen to see as part of the progress towards the regulator. Yeah, perhaps if we get a chance to talk to the sports minister at some point, you know, we could, not that why they'd want to talk to us would be another matter, we could bring that up.
Well, I'm glad you crowbarred that in at the end, Kieran. Why would they want to talk to us? I don't know, but they've asked if they can. They approached us, Kieran, so we will be talking to the sports minister at some stage in the near future, once you've negotiated permission from the Baroness and from Tracy Crouch, obviously.
Dame Tracy Crouch. Congratulations, Tracy. You'll always be my potty mouth princess, but you're a dame to the rest of the country.
Maybe that's what they'll call her, princess. It's one of those terrible news stories. I was listening to the news on the radio, and they mentioned these £5 million donation to the. I was just going, this is shocking. This is outrageous. What are this? And then the last one was Tracy Crouch. I went, oh, well, actually, she probably does deserve it. That was just took the edge off my eye there, Kieran, for a moment. One of the things I'm very proud of about this pod, Kieran, and I'm very proud of a lot of things we've done, but I think the fact that we've given people, or you have given people, fans, the confidence to approach clubs, or the confidence to look at the figures, whereas I think 20 years ago, most football fans would think, well, it's nothing to do with us, we're not allowed to do that. And I think you've changed the mindset a little bit. And also, Man City, that's a very interesting point you make about Man City. Cole Palmer was a classic example, a really good prospect that everyone thought would be at City for some time. And off you go, and that's a quick 50 million quid in the bank, or however much Chelsea paid. Our next question, Kieran, excuse me, comes from Rick Lewis. And Rick is an American Blackburn Rovers fan. Now, Rick, if you're listening to this, I hope you are, I'd love to know how and why that came about. I'm fascinated by how the methodology that people choose in becoming fans of a particular club. But Rick Lewis says, as an American, I have no issue paying for Rovers TV and ESPN Plus and streaming every single Blackburn match live. However, I always hear about the 3 p.m. blackout, and it's easier for me to watch the match than it would be for someone in the UK who didn't want to go to the actual game. Has there ever been serious thought put into an NFL-type model for British football? What I mean is, for much of its existence, games could be broadcast outside of your city, so away fans could watch, but needed to sell out 85% of their tickets before they could be shown in the local market. So you would see businesses or local rich people buying up large chunks of tickets so they could get the free press when the game was aired and could give those tickets away. Is this something that would be financially feasible, or something people would be interested in, or does the current system work just fine?
I think this is a fascinating proposal from Rick, and if it does go ahead, I think you should get a lot of credit for it. The justification for the 3 p.m. blackout is that it is there to protect the clubs in the lower leagues with regard to their ability to get people to turn up on a Saturday. The evidence is that it makes a small difference, and where does that evidence come from? It actually comes from the Champions League. If you take those Tuesdays and Wednesdays when there are Champions League matches taking place, and you've also got matches taking place in the EFL, because you're not allowed under UEFA's rules to have Premier League games taking place on the same nights as Champions League, because they want all of the focus to be on the Champions League. And you compare those to Tuesdays and Wednesdays when there are no Champions League matches, the data suggests that there is a cut in attendances. So
you've got children staying, haven't you?
I've got children staying. I have one of whom it's fair to say
has had some chocolate. Easter egg?
yes. We had some, going to be described as grade A projectile vomiting.
Oh, Lordy.
Following an overexposure to Easter eggs, and they were being rationed, I can assure you. But yes, small children are very adept at when your back's turned. There was some highly entertaining.
But is there, Kieran, is there a lovelier sound in the world than little kids burbling away in the background? I just think it's
absolutely wonderful.
It's the sound of little kids laughing is just fills my heart with glee. It really does.
So could we have some sort of protective scheme operating here in the UK? Feasibly, in theory, yes, it could work. America's a much bigger place than the UK, so that would be a concern. And just how targeted could you have the effectively the local blackouts? I think that would be quite challenging because, you know, if I take sort of the Granada region, for ITV, that covers everything from the north parts of Lancashire down probably as far as Stoke. You've got Merseyside as well. So we do have regional TV. Could we have some sort of regional offering from Sky as well? Everything's feasible. The trouble is, I think what it would result in is you could then have a postcode lottery because ultimately there has to be a barrier. And you could have, you've got a person in number 42 who can watch the match, and the person in number 44 can't because that's deemed to be. So that would cause issues. We've also got the fact that people are quite enterprising these days. So many people use VPNs, virtual private networks, to fool their internet provider as to their geographic location. So that would be quite an easy workaround. I do like the idea that they're having this sort of this threshold of 85% of the seats being sold. And could it be in the club's best interests to sell, in theory, those tickets and then have the match shown live, and because they work out they get more money from getting the live broadcast than selling a few extra tickets? Everything is feasible. So I think it's an intriguing one, an adult discussion on the benefits versus the demerits of the 3 p.m. blackout has to take place at some point. We are consuming broadcast data in a far more different way to even 10 years ago, with the rise of fast speed internet access and stream.
I think increasingly though, Kieran, the 3 o'clock kickoff, it's becoming symbolic rather than actually having a practical effect on the attendances or otherwise at other clubs. For me, that would be one of the last, that would be a line in the sand. There's no logic to it, but for me, removing 3 o'clock kickoffs entirely would be, that would be a season ticket sending back. And I think a lot of fans feel the same way. It feels like something we can protect. And there aren't many things in the game that fans can actually protect and protest about, really. A lot of things are out of our hands, but that sort of thing is something that I think would cause righteous uproar.
I think it would. Quite a few clubs would be absolutely delighted if season tickets were sold back, as we've seen with regards to what's happened at Spurs.
Yeah, fair point.
What would happen at other clubs? And this isn't a criticism of the clubs. Even though we know to which mast our colours are very much tied. The benefits of season ticket holders are far less in respect of those clubs who are substantially oversubscribed in terms of demand. They would rather to shift those fans out. That doesn't mean that they don't care about them. They just say, from a business point of view, especially moving to the new squad control rules point of view, for every £100 we get, that's an extra £70 in wages, and they will sell it like that. But the legacy fan, the old school fan, whatever we want to see ourselves at, we are seen as becoming more of a burden than a benefit, I think, in many boardrooms, and certainly as far as many owners are concerned, if those owners don't have an emotional attachment to the club.
Oh, Americans, you mean? I get you. Matt Wilcox has our next question, Kieran. And I think this is one of the most interesting questions we've had for a long time. All our questions are interesting, and I thank everybody who sends them in. But I'm really, really interested to hear what your answer to this. Matt Wilcox says, I've been thinking about the Dorking Wanderer story ever since you had them on the pod. And it got me thinking, if I went to my local amateur Saturday league club and inquired about who the owner was, I would get some very strange looks. So I'm guessing the majority of amateur clubs are member-owned. At what point in the pyramid do companies start to appear? And when do owners start to make an appearance, fan or otherwise? And how does a club on a run up the pyramid convert from one to the other? In other words, you know, Dorking Wanderers, literally a group of mates playing football on a Saturday afternoon who now find themselves in the National League. And we know the owner's been involved from the start as a player. But I think this is a great question. We do talk about it in our book, Unfit and Improper Persons, but essentially, when does a club become a going concern?
Yeah, I think this is valid. You and I have both played Sunday morning football.
Yeah.
And we both used to give our match subs to somebody, right. One of the lads,
yeah,
or the manager, or the club secretary, whoever was nominated for this. And it was that person's responsibility to pay the ref's fees, to pay for the pitch hire and so on. And there was always rumours that, I bet he doesn't pay for his own subs. He's just back from old days. That's the third one he's had this year. That's our match sub. Especially if you've been dropped. There's always a huge conspiracy with regards to that. So I think what tends to happen is that when a club reaches a point in its development where there are significant potential downsides for failure to pay the bills. So as a members club, the members' liability is normally linked to their annual subs. But once you start to own your own premises, you then have responsibilities. What happens if somebody comes in and offers to buy those? So that's when you might reach the point of seeing the benefits of incorporation. And the benefit of incorporation is that it comes with it something called limited liability status. And limited liability status means that the shareholders, and there's no reason why the members can't become shareholders as part of the transformation of the club. The shareholders are entitled to a slice of the profits should the club be sold at a later stage. So if you're moving to your own ground and somebody wants to effectively fund the purchase of the club, of the club's premises, they might want the protection of saying, well, look, if the club does well, I want to get 51% or 49% of the future benefits, and therefore you move to that status. Now, we do have a relatively new creation, and I think you've got to give credit to the people who came up with this idea of a CIC, which is called a community interest company, which is those types of organisations where the aim of a private limited company is normally to make profit. And there's nothing, and I defend the right of anybody to try to have a successful trade and to make profit from it. Because we do that. We do that as individuals all the time, and there's no reason why you can't do that in a corporate setting. Community interest companies are there where the objective of the company is social, it's environmental, it's community-based, it's charity based. And at the same time, you want the protection is that if things do go wrong for whatever reason, you could have another COVID and your charity goes bust as a result because it can't raise funds. This is an impact that the owners are not hit other than the initial money that they put into their membership fee or their share fee. So that's where we are. As far as where would that be in the football pyramid, I think we were probably looking at perhaps tier 7 or 8, i.e. one tier below the 1 to 2 tiers below National League North, National League South status, where you've got clubs who have their own ground, are probably getting, perhaps 100 people, a couple of hundred people turning up on a regular basis. And also it does focus the mind. It makes you feel that you are slightly more grown up as an organization. So that's where a CIC or a limited company, and it costs you buttons. You can set up a limited company, £12-13 if you do it right. So it shouldn't be prohibitive. It shouldn't act as a barrier in its own right.
You know, Kieran, come to think of it, Roy, who was our secretary, for want of a better word, of our Sunday League team for some years, did have a lot of holidays. But I can't imagine he was funding it from the £28 a week subs that we were paying. Come to think of it as well, Kieran, he had a lot of time off during games as well. He's very easily distracted by squirrels, which is not what you want from your centre back. Normally you have one, you have a trundler, don't you? And then you have a ball playing centre back. We had two trundlers. We couldn't for the life of us find a ball playing centre back.
Yeah. I think it's called a double pivot these days, Kevin.
Probably are, yeah. Roy was a subject to a lot of double pivots in his time, trust me. Ben Beresford has our penultimate question. And Ben Beresford said, last season it was reported that a few top clubs, including Newcastle, were placing bids to sign a Port Vale under-14s player for a reported fee of £200,000. As a Port Vale supporter, brackets, someone's got to, exclamation mark, no, Ben, they're a fine traditional team, I can't help think that if we could keep a player like that a few years longer, by the time they're 16 or 17, they'd be worth a lot more. What protection do clubs like Vale have, if any, regarding keeping their promising young players at the club just for a few more years? Oddly enough, something else we speak about in the book, Kieran, but this is something that exercises football fans at every level, their kids being stolen by bigger clubs.
Yes. And I think you've just used a very interesting words there, their kids, but they're not their kids. Yeah, we are talking about children, but such is the relationship that we have with our football clubs these days, is that we view them as commodities. And this is something which has always perturbed me. And as you know, I've got a big chip on my shoulder about the lack of educational progress that kids in academies make compared to their peer groups and so on. We do have the Elite Player Performance Plan, which does give a set tariff in terms of a child moving from one academy to the other. Now, the tariffs have increased. There's some very good people in fact in legal circles who monitor this very carefully. So the way that it works at present is that if you are under 9 and you move, for example, from Port Vale's academy to Newcastle's academy, you would get £5,000 for every year that child had been in your academy. And let's face it, at the age of 9, you've got no idea whether it'll be a success or not. That goes to £7,500 to £10,000 for under 10s. By the time you get to under 14s, we're talking £25,000 to £80,000 per year at the academy, depending upon whether it is Category 1 or a Category 2 or Category 3 academy. So there is some protection built into the scheme. And I think you have to be very careful here, because what happens if the child is genuinely unhappy at that academy? You know, they've not got a good rapport with some of the coaches. What you don't want is the child to be trapped at a club who let's say you spotted them at the age of 7 or 8. You've got this policy of just, yeah, effectively, if we go back to Willy Wonka, yeah, you've got your giant child catchers net, and you catch as many as possible, and you treat them as commodities, and they're unable to move elsewhere. And there could be a smaller club who actually has got a far more sort of community-based scheme, and the kids there are far happier, and now that child cannot move. And we're talking about somebody who's 12, 13, 14. So trying to get the trade-off between the compensation that is paid and the ability of the child to move, I think is a challenging one. I think there should be greater emphasis on the outputs. So perhaps have slightly lower fees or keep the fees where they are at present, because they've only gone up once since EPP was formed, to my knowledge, to keep those initial fees lower. But if that child then goes on to have a professional career in the game, then greater compensation is given to the academy, which was responsible for the development. So, you know, if you've got 20 Premier League matches, instead of the money you get at present, which is pretty low, I think it's around about 250 grand. If you've got somebody with 20 PL matches, you know, let's face it, Cole Palmer, he didn't have 20 Premier, and Manchester City, you know, got 40 plus million out of Chelsea for him. So it's a case of getting the balance right. There are positives about EPPP. There are negatives about the way that it does allow the larger clubs to effectively act as factory farms and get all the best talent at a young age. People will say, well, there's good news. You look at the number of former academy players who are now in the England team, and England have got a very young team. Yeah, I think we are quietly hopeful we could have a decent Euros on the back of that. But I don't think that balance is quite right, because ultimately EPPP was designed by the Premier League for the Premier League, and as part of the deal which guaranteed EFL clubs a share of the Premier League TV money, albeit a small share, was that they had to sign up to EPPP. So they weren't given a choice. It was, you know, we will take away solidarity payments unless you go along. If the scheme was that good, you wouldn't have to make that threat.
Yeah, before we get angry tweets, Kieran, I should point out that the child catcher, of course, is from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, not from Willy Wonka. You know, this is the sort of thing that exercises our listeners' minds more than anything else. I think, to be fair to clubs, Kieran, our research has indicated that academies now, they do everything they can. Academies are fantastic. They do everything they can to ensure the physical and mental welfare of the young people under their care. But as you keep saying, they are children, and yeah, you know, children are changing all the time. There's all sorts of stuff going on in their bodies and their minds, and it does leave you uneasy sometimes when you're reading about 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds being moved around. And, you know, but there you are. Unfortunately, it's the nature of modern football. Our last question, Kieran, I really like. Again, I think it's another cracking question, and it comes from Matthew Fleming. And Matthew says, I was casually flicking through my 1981-82 West Bromwich Albion programme collection the other day, and to save me a job, Matthew's put in brackets, as you do, right, which is obviously the sort of thing I would have said straight away. And Matthew says, as I was flicking, I came across a fascinating article, which was all based around the hypothesis that the entire transfer market was completely banned and clubs could only field their homegrown players. Which, you know, the idea of a club only fielding homegrown players wasn't that preposterous back in 1981, 1982. To be honest, says Matthew, I suspect the author of the article was understandably bitter at the time, as we'd just been strong-armed by a turncoat Ron Atkinson into selling Brian Robson and Remy Moses to Man United for a record £2 million. Oh, that's dated, isn't it, that programme collection? I was just... I just love the fact that Matthew's still as bitter about the author of the article as well. I was just wondering, were this unlikely situation to actually materialise in the modern era era, which club do you think would be able to field the most valuable starting 11 of homegrown players? Now, I would guess Man City, Kieran.
I have that written down as well. Certainly, I think we would be looking at a large City club because they have that benefit of a catchment area. They've also got the ability, the likes of Manchester City and Manchester United, of course, would be very much be top dog in the locality, which they are at present in terms of attracting young talent. The same would apply to London. I think, you know, as far as you're concerned at Palace, you've, to a certain extent, you've got a large, you know, a large area of South London, which you can claim as your own. I think the big issue for me, how do you define homegrown? You know, if you say it's got to be within 5 miles of the stadium, then if you're a club like Brighton who's got an out-of-town stadium, you're knackered because you've got bits of sea, you've got an awful lot of the South Downs, and you've got people in Lewis who make people at Brighton look very, very non-latte. So, you know, it would be intriguing. We're old enough to remember the Lisbon Lions of Celtic in 1967. Yeah. What was that? They all came from within 20 to 30 miles of, of Glasgow itself.
They all came from within 12 miles. I think the furthest one.
Oh, wow.
The furthest one away was from 30 miles, I think. So God, right. God knows what they're made of his accent. But no, they're all they're all remarkably and three or four of them were within yards. So I mean, yeah,
amazing.
It's a great example.
So it would very much be tilted towards the larger cities. I think you could come up with a formula if you were a club which didn't have no clubs within 30 or 40 miles. You'd say, well, they're all homegrown because where else do they go? So it would be fascinating. I was actually at Old Trafford when Remy Moses signed.
Wow.
Because I think it was in my first year at university. So I used to go and watch United and City every week because it was a pound. Yeah, it was I think it was £1.20 to watch United and £1 to watch City. It was ridiculously cheap. And those were the proper signings where the club would bring a table and a chair onto the pitch and the player would walk onto the pitch and sign a contract. And you go, oh, this is proper football, this is it.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because you go, oh, look at the way he walks to that chair. He's good, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's striding.
Tasty.
Yeah, he can hold the pen as
look at the width of that tie as well.
You see, you talk about Palace's traditional catchment area. We now have we've got a Sunday session in Battersea Park now. We're competing with Fulham and Chelsea. Steve Parish is over the moon. Steve Parish is like the proverbial... I was going to say dog with two, the proverbial cat with two tails. Yes, yeah, we're competing with Chelsea. Yeah, the Category One Academy has made a huge difference in terms of recruiting talent. And Steve Parish is honest enough to say that having a Category One Academy means you can be more of a predator than before. Yeah. So you can spread out your catchment area. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, that'd be very kind of you. And it will get you access to our chat community and our regular quizzes. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And you can go to the same website to buy that book we've been talking about or one of our rare Price of Football t-shirts. We will be back with our news pod on Thursday. Hopefully more on that Manchester United story. But in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks as always for those people that do get in touch, and also the people that I do make errors, as Kevin has pointed out, on a variety of subjects, and we're always willing to acknowledge that. There's a variety of ways in which you can support the show. One of those is to go down the Patreon route and avoid adverts, if that's what you so desire. Another way is to give us a review. It helps us in terms of being seen to be a modern show because if the reviews are relatively recent. And you can write whatever you want in the review, such as this one from Fatfish59, Just one thing, I'd rather it was presented by Marcel Marceau and Sandra Dickinson. I can see a slight problem with that.
Yeah, there is a slight problem. I used to do Cheltenham for Five Live, the festival. It was a job I loved doing. I did it for 12 years. I was like the useful idiot. It was my job to ask the questions on behalf of, and, you know, would find interesting people around the stadium, the course, rather, to talk to. And John Inverdale threw to me live on air, I have to say, because the producer had found this very, very good Charlie Chaplin lookalike who'd been entertaining the crowds. As Charlie Chaplin looked like. So we said, have a few words with him. I love the history of Cullen. So, you know, speaking to this very nice chap. And then John, so we went live, and then he didn't say a word for 3 minutes, didn't say anything. And all I could hear was John Inverdale pissing himself laughing in my headphones. So I threw back to John, and I just said to Charlie Chaplin, what the f-? He went, I was in character. I said, mate, he didn't speak in the films because they didn't have the technology to make people speak in films. Charlie Chaplin was famously garrulous. Charlie Chaplin was a great. He just had me standing there for 3 minutes. So I said, they've only got my word. I actually had Charlie Chaplin next to me. I could have been just talking into. Ah, the vagaries of live broadcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter, everybody. The Price of Football.
Picture this, the roar of a crowd, the tension building, the electrifying moment your team scores the winning goal. Pure joy, right? But for many football fans, barriers can shut them out of that experience. In the UK, nearly 1 in 4 people, that's 16 million, have a disability. And over 70% of those disabilities are non-visible.
There's a really broad range of non-visible disabilities out there. So it can be hearing loss, it can be sight loss, it can be neurodiversity, it can be any manner of things that people can't perceive.
People look, why are they parking in a blue badge space? They can walk. Why are they using an accessible toilet? They're walking in. But that's not the point. You can't see the invisibleness of the disability. But then if somebody's judging you, you can tell they haven't got the awareness. They haven't got the understanding.
I've always lived my life as a sighted person who can't see. To the point where then if I didn't have my long cane, chances are a lot of people wouldn't know. Me having it isn't always just for me, but it is actually for other people as well.
Find out how you can contribute to a more inclusive matchday experience for everyone by supporting Level Playing Field, the national charity advocating for greater access and inclusion for all disabled sports fans through its Unite for Access campaign. Unite for your team, unite as a fan. Let's unite for access.